Welcome, everybody, to Podcasting Them Softly, episode number 11. This is Nick. I am joined, of course, with Frank. What's going on, Frank?
Hello.
There he is. We are going to be discussing Brian De Palma's Femme Fatale this week, a film that I have been obsessed with for a long time and one that Frank has now gotten a chance to see and also, I believe, fall head over heels with, for lack of a better phrase. We're going to be getting into Femme Fatale. We're going to talk about Antonio Banderas' top five performances in a little bit of a twist on the format. Instead of picking one actress for top five, we're going to be doing the top five Femme Fatales, which can stretch from any actress in any film from any era. And at the end of the show, we'll get into a couple of new trailers that debuted and highlight some Blu-rays and recent collectible purchases, if there's been any. So we'll just get right into it. Brian De Palma, for those of you who are not aware, I'm assuming that most people know who Brian De Palma is. Major filmmaker, part of the class of the 60s and 70s with guys like Scorsese and Spielberg coming up with that group of filmmakers, and Coppola as well, and sort of the ultimate ode to Hitchcock filmmaker, guy who's been in love with noir, has been in love with film, with thrillers, with horror, psychological, and both more overtly violent. He's been into satire, he's done war films, done science fiction. He's sort of touched on almost every genre. But the things that Brian De Palma is best known for are what we refer to as the sleazy thriller, stuff like Body Double and Sisters and Dressed to Kill and Femme Fatale and other films that have touched on these sort of themes, the most recent one being Passion. He's a filmmaker who's been obsessed with sex and violence his whole career, and the power of the female form, and also sort of a filmmaker who's been obsessed with women in every form that, you know, they sort of take on in cinema. And the really exciting thing about Femme Fatale is that it found him working with European money. So he did not have a studio hanging over his shoulder to tell him yes or no. He was able to basically make the movie that he wanted to make, which is always exciting when a filmmaker who always has such a strong vision to begin with gets to really go at it and make the movie that they've always wanted to make, which, in my opinion, if you're a fan of De Palma and know his work, this movie would certainly qualify as possibly the apex of his obsessions and desires. The film is extremely visual, as always for De Palma. He's always been known to have multiple great set pieces in his movies, whether it be a big Hollywood blockbuster like Mission Impossible, or even in something which I consider to sort of be a failure overall, The Black Dahlia. There's numerous sequences in that point to his great strengths as a filmmaker. So even in his lesser works, he's always been a director who's stressed intense visual technique. He's often worked with the cinematographer Stephen H. Burham on many movies, and he's always been a guy who's wanted to explore the visual language of cinema and telling stories with pictures. And here in Femme Fatale, he gets the ultimate chance to do that. For people who are not familiar with the movie and sort of don't want to tread so heavily on spoilers as to ruin the surprise, because this movie does offer a lot in the way of surprise. But basically, you are given a sort of dream logic film that involves a sleazy paparazzi photographer played by Antonio Banderas, and he is tasked with taking some photographs of an American ambassador's wife. Now, the American ambassador's wife, played by Rebecca Romijn, at the time Rebecca Romijn Stamos, now Rebecca Romijn, she has a little bit more than, you know, more than meets the eye, as they would say. She's hiding out. There's some issues of identity, stolen identity. The film opens with a nearly wordless 30-minute sequence that is a diamond heist and also a sexual tryst between Rebecca Romijn and another woman. And Brian De Palma here in this sequence gets to really flex his muscles and show everybody what he's all about. It is an absolutely incredible, incredible opening bit that just really sucks you into the film, as good as the opening in Snake Eyes, I would say, where something that just grabs you, never lets you go, and forces you to pay attention, doing a lot of it without dialogue. And basically what you get is a film that is always one step ahead of you, and it's a movie that is operating on multiple levels, and it isn't until the very end that everything sort of comes together. You are able to follow it. It is coherent, but it is a movie that does ask you to ask some questions while you were watching it about where it is going from a story standpoint. And the thing that I find so exciting about it is that it really, really, really showcases Brian De Palma's love for film noir. And I mean, just right off the bat, the opening scene of the film, you have Rebecca Romijn back to camera, topless, in bed, watching the ultimate femme fatale on screen, Barbara Stanwyck, in Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity, which is just a lovely moment in and of itself. But when you sort of step back at by the end of the film and realize what you've watched, it's it's even more exciting to think about De Palma paying homage to a film like that while also getting a chance to flex his own cinematic muscles. And again, also getting a chance to really riff hard on the Hitchcockian notion of confusion, of identity, and of the sort of sensual nature that can come with strangers meeting and not knowing exactly what's going on. This is a movie that loves itself. It loves movie making. And it's a film that's unafraid of sexuality. Brian De Palma asked his star, Rebecca Romijn, to definitely go to some intensely sexualized places. And I think part of the reason why the movie is so successful is because she was ultimately unafraid and willing to sort of go as far as De Palma was asking her. You never get a sense of any reserve on her part. So it's a film I've had a chance to see a lot since 2002. I saw it twice in the theater, and it's a film that I've watched repeatedly throughout the years and something I've just come to love even more. And I know, Frank, you just had a chance to check it out this week for the first time. What's your initial take on it? And hopefully you'll want to check it out even more in the future.
Yeah, I absolutely love Brian De Palma, and I haven't seen all of his films. I've seen most of them. Femme Fatale was one of the bigger ones that I had not seen, but I bought it a while ago because I knew one day I was going to watch it. I loved it upon probably the first 15 minutes of the film, because it is staple De Palma with his, I think Brian De Palma's two different filmmakers. I think there's Brian De Palma, the filmmaker, and then I think there's Brian De Palma, big budget filmmaker. And I think his fingerprints are on the bigger films, Untouchable, Scarface, what's the other, Mission Impossible. I like how he can switch to mainstream, but Femme Fatale falls into the blowout, Dress to Kill, sisters category, which I really love. I love Dress to Kill, and I love Blowout in particular. I've probably watched each of them at least 10 times each, probably more. I mean,
you've seen Body Double.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Body Double. I forgot to include Body Double in the Dress to Kill sisters Blowout category, because that's De Palma, De Palma. That's the De Palma that loves film, and I love watching De Palma films because this guy loves movies, absolutely loves movies, whether it's an homage to Battleship Potemkin, a la The Untouchables, or more specifically Hitchcock. De Palma loves Hitchcock, and I think De Palma is the most Hitchcockian modern-day director, and you can tell that from his core seminal films. But to get back to Femme Fatale, I liked it. I mean, right away, the opening scene is fantastic. It sets the tone with sexuality and mystery rather quickly. And what I loved about it, man, is my favorite thing about Brian De Palma is his use of split screen. Mm. I am obsessed with split screen in film. You don't see it very much, and most of the time when you see it, it's used as a gimmick. It's not gimmicky with De Palma. What I love is there is so much on screen in a De Palma film that you can't only watch a movie once to fully get it. There is so much action on the screen, whether it's subtle or he's focusing you to watch one certain thing. There's so much to watch in a De Palma film, and there's so much to pick up each time you watch it. And the genius of De Palma is he throws in a split screen, and it's double the work for your brain, essentially. It's all the detail of a standard shot split into two, particularly with just speaking of Femme Fatale with the first split screen with Rebecca Romijn talking outside and Banderas seeing her and starting to take pictures, and then you're seeing the same action but from two different viewpoints. It's genius, man.
Yeah, the playing with perspective is – yeah, it's fantastic. And he like you said, the split screen stuff is used to maximum effect in Femme Fatale, and you're so right. He's a guy that he's like one of those filmmakers that is obsessed with filling the frame with information, be it visual or on a written level. But with Femme Fatale, you just get this sense that he was trying to make as visual of a movie as possible. I mean, like, you have that great scene. Like, how many times in a movie have you seen people shown in slow motion where there's actual dialogue being spoken? You know what I'm talking about? When Black Tie...
Oh, exactly. Yeah,
like, there's, like, all these great, fantastic little... And to sort of also to that... It's not split screen, but how many times does he pull the shot in this film where two people are in focus, one in the foreground and one in the background, which is like nearly impossible to pull off as far as I know from what I know about cinematography. And I'm not obviously a cameraman, but I do know that that's not an easy thing to do. He does that like half a dozen times. The movie is like it's almost the ultimate film school movie in a way, because it's like this guy that is so obsessed with having fun with the conventions of cinema. And he knows what's possible when you don't play it safe and when you try like a ton of different things. So I don't want it to make it feel like it's a student film, but it's a movie that feels like it's been made with a passion for film that comes, and to say nothing of his knowledge of film noir and the tropes that come with the noir film and all of the various things that he pays homage to, but then also spices up. I mean, like, this is the movie, right, that Billy Wilder would have loved to have made had he been allowed to have nudity and cursing and some violence. I mean, like, you know, I can't help but feel that Femme Fatale is sort of like the ultimate companion piece in a lot of respects to Double Indemnity. And Double Indemnity is one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. I mean, that movie I've watched as much as Femme Fatale, if not more. And, you know, I love the self-reflexive nature of De Palma to start his noir with the first, you know, or not the first, but start his noir with images from the ultimate noir, and then also tell a story that feels completely original in its own way, but one that feels cut from the cloth of, you know, other modern filmmaking. I mean, this is almost like his David Lynch movie in a way, if you even want to go there. I mean,
oh, it is.
The Mulholland Drive sort of narrative twists, you know, that are in that film, you know, while they're not necessarily maybe as intense in Femme Fatale, but this one feels to me like his Mulholland Drive or his David Lynch movie, you know, through the prism of the noir, which makes it even more exciting. And it's a movie that got extremely divisive reviews. It's 50-50 right down the middle at Rotten Tomatoes. It's set at 50% for the last 13 years. I don't think it's moved. And I've read all the reviews. And people like Roger Ebert absolutely flipped out, and rightfully so. Manola Dargis, you know, also wrote a great review. But then you had people who just couldn't get past the casting of Rebecca Romijn and couldn't, I guess, give her a chance. And people, I think, are also so – I don't know if it's that they're offended sometimes by Brian De Palma, and because of how stylish things are and because of how brazen they are, I think that he gets under people's skin, don't you?
Yeah, I think he's I think he's an audacious filmmaker. He's never made a film that doesn't go for it. He never half-asses anything, whether the film ends up being great or a missed shot.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Like Black Dahlia, much as I can appreciate that, and I haven't seen that for a long time. But think about
Mission to Mars, something like
Mission
that.
Mission to Mars, I like that movie a lot. I forgot he actually did that.
Yeah, he did Mission
to
Mars.
That's a goodie.
And it's like, I remember seeing that film in the theater and being like initially let down, and I've seen it in throughout the years, and I've liked it even more.
I forgot he did that.
Yeah, he did Mission to Mars. Remember the crying alien at the end?
That movie's so good.
Yeah.
I love what that movie says. That's a good movie.
The movie does have some really cool things to say. There's a couple of scenes and a couple of bits that I wish were like a little bit more well handled in some respects. But you're right. You're absolutely right. There's never a moment where you feel like Brian De Palma has ever been on autopilot. Like never. And you can never say that about, you know, great filmmakers. You know, hopefully you can't say that about great filmmakers, but he is a great filmmaker who has never made a movie that has felt like that it's on. I mean, listen, what kind of guy could make Phantom of the Paradise and Mission Impossible? I mean,
right.
How does that happen?
Mean,
like, you know, how
De Palma,
are you?
De Palma's on the same class as, or same tier as Scorsese and he's contemporaries with Scorsese and Coppola, and well, maybe Coppola's not the best example.
Well,
but,
he was in that group. They were in, you know, that group showing each other all their movies and stuff. Is from what I
right.
I've
I just
read,
meant
you know,
I just
like,
meant in like the film the scope
yes,
of his filmography.
Exactly.
But let's just stick with Scorsese. I mean, he's definitely a contemporary to Scorsese. I think Scorsese has a better filmography, but I think they're both on the same caliber when it comes to filmmaking. The thing with Scorsese is he's more mainstream most of the time. De Palma's just outrageous, man. Thinking of his whole filmography, Scarface, holy God. I mean, that is one of the most outrageous and larger than life films I've ever seen in my entire life. And it's great. And then he pivots so much in his career, and the audacity of Scarface, and then, you know, my favorite De Palma's Dress to Kill, and I don't want to get too far into that because I do want to talk about Femme Fatale, but and plus I don't want to give away any spoilers to Dress to Kill. But Dress to Kill is incredibly audacious with who the killer is in that film. I mean, that is insane to me. Even when I watch it to this day, I can't even believe it. That movie ever got made. And he's always been gratuitous with sex and violence, and his staples, body double, Dress to Kill, Femme Fatale is a perfect example. Femme Fatale is more interesting to me in a way. Rebecca Romijn, I've never not liked her in a movie. I thought she was good as Mystique. I thought she was good in The Punisher. I haven't seen a lot of stuff she's in. She's perfectly fine in Femme Fatale. She doesn't blow me away. She kind of does with the striptease scene and stuff. But you know what I mean. It's not like, but also think of, he's always had interesting leading ladies.
Oh, yeah.
Now that I think about it, who is his wife, Nancy, what's her face? Nancy Allen?
Yeah.
From Dress to Kill and Body, or Dress to Kill and Blowout. I mean, she was not the conventional leading lady. She's not the, you know, and then Angie, the aged Angie Dickinson in Dress to Kill. And then, Rebecca Romijn in Femme Fatale. But getting back to what I was originally trying to say, what I think's interesting is Antonio Banderas' casting in Femme Fatale. He shouldn't be in this movie. I feel like Antonio Banderas doesn't fit the De Palma film noir Hitchcockian mold. And that's what's so interesting about this film. He's the tall, dark stranger, which is awesome, but that's supposed to be the role of the female in the film. Do you know what I'm trying to say with that? It's casting against type. I would imagine when this screenplay was written, Antonio Banderas probably never crossed his mind, and it would be a more conventional actor, I think, that would play this part. But Antonio Banderas is perfectly suited for what this film is. And his character's so interesting. He's not the lead. Rebecca Romijn is clearly the lead. He doesn't really show up.
Yeah, he doesn't show up until 45 minutes into the movie.
Right, and he doesn't do much. I mean, but once he comes into the film and gets tangled in her
web, raveled, yeah.
Right, tangled in her web, he's glorious in it. But what I also love is the conventionality of De Palma's authorship by the sweeping crane shots, the overhead crane shots of big scenes, like the slow motion fight scene with the truck coming down the alley on the cobblestone. You know, the split screen, the casting of Greg Henry, that guy's been in so many De Palma films, and he's great. I always love Greg Henry.
Yeah, he's like, and the ultimate sleazeball.
He is, man. And I mean, that's another thing with De Palma, and perfectly goes hand in hand with his casting of Banderas, is a bulk of De Palma's films there's never been a conventional leading man. I mean, I guess aside from like Nicolas Cage and even John Travolta in Blowout, I mean, you have Greg Henry and Craig Wasson and Body Double, and then Michael Caine and Keith Gordon in Dressed to Kill.
Yeah,
and then I'm not sure.
Yeah, you get some, sorry to interrupt. You get a freaky movie like Raising Cain. You know, John Lithgow giving
this,
like, great off kilter, like weird performance. You know, this crazy performance. Yeah, he's, again, like we said before, he's a guy that has made so many different types of thrillers and so many different types of movies that he's been able to switch back and forth between playing it for them and playing it for him. And, you know, I think that Banderas, on the face of it, you're right. Like, you know, is he exactly the first guy you think of? Maybe not. But when you see him with the greasy hair and that jacket and snapping the photos and, you know, being an asshole while he's like grabbing the photos too, like making catcalls and yelling at her and stuff, you know, he doesn't know who she is. You get the sense that this is a guy who has been enjoying this sleazy way of life, and
right.
and then he becomes the ultimate, you know, again, without spoiling everything, he becomes the ultimate patsy for De Palma to sort of play every trick, you know, on and against. Because again, without spoiling everything, you get so many opportunities during Femme Fatale to ask yourself, what's going on? What exactly is happening? What is Rebecca Romijn thinking? What's she doing? And because of how the film is, you know, structured, and because of the way that it's, the scenes at the, I'll just say it, the scenes at the house where she's in the tub, you know, those scenes sort of frame the full, you know, action of the movie. So
right.
When you've gotten a chance to see it a few times and you see, how the screws have been turned on Banderas' character and how he is, you know, how he's specifically being used, it's really fun to watch. And, you know, it's like, I have to, we of course have to probably bring up the striptease scene, because while it is obviously sexually showboating and it's clearly a look at me type of thing that's going on, what I absolutely love about that scene, what I'm always going to love about that scene, is the subtext that's going on. She's going to do this crazy strip tease for this guy that is obviously going to get hot and bothered and want a little bit more than she's willing to do. And she knows it's going to piss off Antonio Banderas, and she knows it's going to lead to a fight. And I just love the response that she gets when you see them fighting in shadow while that the light from the bar is swinging.
Right.
You know, and you just watch her laughing and clapping and like hooting and hollering. And you get the sense that this woman is just totally fucking crazy and that she's nuts, and that De Palma loves that about it. Like, he's
it, the title's Femme Fatale, which is great. I mean, she's the ultimate, she's the Femme
and
Fatale.
She tells, he has you tell, she, he has her tell you, the audience, she says, I'm a bad girl, I'm real bad, rotten to the core. She tells you right up, like, in the middle of the movie, which is, I just,
right.
One of my favorite parts. And, you know, you don't, it's like, you don't want to believe it, you know, you don't want to, it's like, you don't think about it, and it's just this great, it's this great fun that De Palma is having with the viewer and with everything that you bring in to your expectations of a film like this. So.
Yeah. Before I cover the striptease scene, which is awesome. Back to the casting and how De Palma's audacious and Antonio Banderas really doesn't fit the mold to the film. And, you know, I think of split screen in this film, and I think of the sweeping crane shots in this film. And De Palma's one of those filmmakers where I've said this about Scorsese and Kubrick and Malick, where you're watching, and you know, like every camera movement is a brush stroke by the artist, and he's painting this gigantic picture for you. And you're right. I mean, this is a cohesive film, but at once it gets to that jugular of the film where everything kind of flips and you're like, what is going on here? Is he going to explain this at all? The thing that I love about this film is the casting of Peter Coyote.
Mm.
And I think Peter Coyote's the great stabilizer in the film, because I've always liked Coyote. He's never had a gargantuan career, but he's always the straight man. And I think that casting Coyote in this film is in a way De Palma saying, it's okay, I know what I'm doing, Peter Coyote's here, we're going to be fine. I honestly felt that, because I was excited. I forgot that Peter Coyote was in this. I saw his name in the credits, and I was like, yes, Peter Coyote in a De Palma movie. I can't wait to see this. And he's the U.S. ambassador. Like, who else is Peter Coyote going to play? It's perfect. It's pitch perfect casting. And I think that that adds so much validity and stability to the storyline that at times is absolutely outrageous, but you're still going with it because it's still so interesting. Man, De Palma is such a smart filmmaker.
And he doesn't get the credit. Like, that's what's
no.
That's what's always bothered me, is that here's a guy that makes stylish movie after stylish movie after stylish movie.
Look, let me just jump in here.
Tries not to repeat himself in a row, but obviously has multiple obsessions that he wants to come back to throughout his career. He's not somebody like a Scorsese who spent half of his career making one type of a film. You know, and as much as I love Scorsese, you know, a lot of his movies have centered around Italian gangsters or that milieu or that sort of, you know, that.
Yeah, but I mean, but De Palma's things are erotic thrillers.
I know, but getting back to your point earlier, he's been a guy who's done a sci-fi film. He's done a massive tentpole. He's done the studio thriller. He's done war films. I mean, he did Phantom of the Paradise. Like, I still say, like, who the hell makes Phantom of the Paradise and Casualties of War? Like, it's like astounding. Like, to me, he's one of the ultimate filmmakers that never got his due. Has he? I mean,
I agree.
And honestly, and I should know this because I'm a huge fan. Has he ever been nominated for an Academy Award?
I don't think so, because record? I was just thinking that. Maybe for The Untouchables. I don't know. I'd have to look. Maybe not. I mean, you're right. De Palma's always been unfairly shit on, and I just don't understand what it is. I think he's somehow an offensive filmmaker.
Yeah. I think
I don't get, unless he's like an asshole in real life. I don't know that. I can't imagine. He always seems nice and everything in interviews, but that's beside the point. But, you know, this isn't going to be the last De Palma film we're going to talk about on our podcast, because I'm going to want to talk about Dress to Kill. It's one of my favorites. We're going to want to both talk about Body Double. I know that.
I mean, it's just like one of the ultimate dissections of the movie industry that's ever been done. So,
you know, even Snake Eyes, I think, is great. I think it's got a bad ending.
Me too. I love Snake Eyes, even with
but
the bad
I can
ending.
Get, I
that
can
wasn't
get,
even...
I, exactly. I can get over the ending to Snake Eyes, because that opening scene, the whole one shot of following Cage around and him being like out, him being Nicolas Cage and the boxing and the boxing scene that turns into the assassination. It's just like, oh, this. Every time you watch a De Palma film, I don't give a fuck what movie it is, even if it's Black Dahlia, which I do want to revisit. You're watching a master artisan at work, and you know, Femme Fatale, I need to watch it again to really kind of gauge my lasting feel for the film. But upon my initial viewing, I mean, I loved it. Because he's so good at making these films. And, you know, if somebody else would have made Femme Fatale, it wouldn't have been what it is. I mean, if somebody just would have straight-laced shot this film, you know, to point A, to point B, to point C, it wouldn't have been as good. It probably would have been just this shitty, erotic thriller. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It all hinges upon the striptease scene, and all hinges upon Rebecca Romijn Stamos being naked, or seeing her naked, or seeing her in her underwear. But it is the complexity of the detail that De Palma brings to this film. And I'm going to go back to it again. Man, that the split screen, Jesus. I mean, his split screen is so amazing and influential that Tarantino took it and put it in Kill Bill Volume 1 when the bride is laying in the hospital bed and Daryl Hannah is dressed in that outrageous nurse outfit and she's walking down the hallway corridor in the hospital to kill the bride with lethal injection. That is clearly De Palma. And Tarantino has even said that that's his homage to De Palma. I mean, If that doesn't show you what kind of a filmmaker and the lasting effect he has on other filmmakers, I don't know what would.
Yeah.
I mean, Tarantino doesn't need to do that in a film. He doesn't need to put the split screen with like the crazy whistling music that sounds like it's out of Sisters or Dress to Kill or something outrageous like that. I mean,
yeah, he's left a lasting impression on any number of filmmakers, and he's a guy that has always been, first and foremost, all about pure cinema. He's been about a guy who has said, what about this scene can I do to make it even more cinematic? His movies have, he's never been a faux doc verite guy. He's been a guy who loves his camera movement, who loves his sound design, who loves his cinematography, a guy that loves the artifice of film. And instead of being bogged down by ostentatious style that doesn't go anywhere, doesn't add anything to, you know, the equation, he's always able to include, for the most part, I would say, he's always interested in the story and the character and everything being born out of that. I think that he's just the kind of guy that rubs people wrong. He likes sex. He likes women. He likes to photograph them. He likes violence. He likes to see violence happening to women. There's been stuff that's been written about this numerous times, about his, especially in the 80s, about is he a misogynist? Is Body Double the ultimate, you know, attack on women? I mean, some of the reviews that have been written about it and some of the pieces are insane. And I think that it's completely the opposite. He's a filmmaker who loves women. He's a filmmaker who's obsessed with them. He's a filmmaker who knows that women can bring a man down instantaneously. And he's been obsessed with telling these stories of how men are consistently one-upped by women. And for people to have said for so long that he's a misogynist and he doesn't like female, he pays no respect. It's just blind idiocy. Like, you have to look at his work a little bit harder and notice that, you know, it's the complete opposite. I did do a little homework behind the scenes. He has never been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Director.
That's so fucked up.
The Venice Film Festival has nominated 1, 2, 3, 4 of his movies for the Golden Lion, 4 different films, or the Silver Lion. He's been nominated for an obscene amount of Razzie Awards because, you know, Brian De Palma, for some reason, deserved a Razzie Award nomination for Scarface. Okay? Like, you know, what's that about? The best sort of critical attention that has been paid to Brian De Palma, arguably, are the 2 nominations that he received from the New York Film Critics Circle Awards. In 89, he got 2nd place for Casualties of War. And in 1980, he was nominated for Dress to Kill. Other than that, it's all European stuff. You know, he's another filmmaker of Berlin, you know, the Caesar Awards. He's another filmmaker who's been lionized in Europe, but for whatever reason, American critics have been cool to him, you know, with the exception of A Passionate Bunch. I mean, when Roger Ebert was around, there was very few critics other than Ebert who, like, I mean, and he would take him to task here and there. There were some movies that he didn't like, especially Snake Eyes, which I think he was wrong on. But Ebert really got Brian De Palma's interests, and he understood it, because Ebert came from the same place. He was a guy who loved cinema and the power of cinema. And that's what De Palma's always been about. He's always been just as jazzed about his movies as Scorsese has been.
Yeah, I mean, look at this guy's filmography. I mean, he has his De Palma films, which are his De Palma films, right? I mean, we've brushed over those. And then he's got, you know, Scarface, The Bonfire of the Vanities, Carlito's Way
Mission is so Impossible. Underrated. It's not even funny.
That movie is so underrated.
It's not even funny how underrated that movie is. Like, that movie gets no respect.
That movie is great. It is the spiritual cousin to Scarface, and it's perfect. It's absolutely, like, De Palma being like, all right, let's make another. Is that in the 80s? It is. No.
Carlito's Way was 91, I think, right?
93. But it's very. I don't know. It's very 80s-esque from Sean Penn's Jewy lawyer character. Everything. I mean, he even recasts a bunch. I mean, essentially, who's missing from that film
gets Penn to rock the fro in that, the white man afro in that movie.
He rocks the Art Garfunkel. Awesome.
The ridiculous helicopter shot in that film where Penn is walking. I'm trying to remember where it's like the most ridiculous helicopter shot where the camera is like up close on him and he's walking this long distance and the helicopter pulls way back. It's like, even in some of the smallest instances, De Palma, you know, sort of like a Tony Scott. He was always interested in cinema and what can the camera do and how can I be more exciting? How can I convey this in a visual way that you haven't seen before? And that's up the yin yang in Femme Fatale. I mean, you like from the split screen to the slow-mo to the folding and the folding over on itself, the narrative, and to you know, the movie within the movie sort of in the beginning, which is lovely. You know, they're at the Cannes Film Festival and this is all going on. It just sort of feels like the ultimate explosion of all of his different pet peeves that he wanted to throw into a film. And again, I think it's kind of like every once in a while, a filmmaker, if they're lucky, gets $20 million or $30 million of European money with some guy like a dry cleaning mogul, which I think are, I don't know if he's a dry cleaning mogul, but like Tarak Ben Amar, the guy who produced, he produced Femme Fatale, and I believe that he produced Passion for Brian De Palma. Did you see Passion with Rachel McAdams?
I didn't. I haven't seen Passion, and I haven't seen Redacted. And didn't Mark Cuban give him money to do Redacted?
Yeah, Cuban gave him money to do Redacted, which got absolutely annihilated by people. I think that it's a stunningly interesting piece of form.
Look what it came out, and look at the subject matter of it.
Of course, and I do think that some of the acting in that movie was amateurish, possibly on purpose. And I do think that movie was, as I recall, I've only seen it once. It was unbelievably angry, that film. But that movie was as bold as you could get. It was not interested in playing it safe. It went for the jugular right at a time when people were still pissed off with the Iraq War. I mean, not that we're not now, but that came out in the heat of it, and he went right for it. He's always been the kind of guy who's going to appeal to the studios because they know at one point, at least, it doesn't seem like he hasn't been very prolific of late, and he's 75 years old. But he was one of those guys where the studios knew they could call him and they would get their film. But then he was also the kind of guy that in the back of his pocket, he knew that there was something that he really needed to tell, a story that he needed to tell. Femme Fatale feels like one of those movies that he really needed to tell. And the fact that he was able to get it made the way he got it made, I'll always feel like this is his, to take your phrase, this was his Bob Fosse moment. This was his.
Oh, for sure.
You know, this is his domino. This is his movie where he's given the free rein and you know, somebody says to him, well, I like you, Brian. I'm going to give you whatever you want to do. And I'm not going to say no. And that's what you get from this film, you know, especially with the sex and the violence and the really just the sensuality of it is what gets me too. Like, it is sexy. But it's also very sensual, which are obviously two different things. And the fact that Rebecca Romijn was able to convey both of those and also convey vulnerability and convey, you know, the possibility for danger, for murder. I think it's an awesome performance. And De Palma knew her limitations, I think. This is when she was just starting. She had done sitcom work. She had done three movies in a row, back to back to back, I believe. And this was one of them in that three. She did Rollerball. She did this one. And I think there was one other, like, Simone, I think that she was do you ever see Andrew Nichols Simone with,
she's not Simone though, right?
And I don't know if she was Simone or if she was in that film or something. There were three movies that came out in 2002, 2003, where she did them all back to back to back, but without having a ton of real intense actorly experience, he got a heck of a...
she isn't Simone.
Yeah, right. I thought so. She gives a heck of a performance when you think about it. She's got to do a French accent. She's got to play multiple versions of herself, quote unquote. She's got to be sad 1 minute, crazy the next, sexy 1 minute, bruised the next.
I think she did good. I don't think there should be any negativity warranted towards Rebecca Romijn's performance in that film. I think she's perfect for it. I mean, who else is going to play that?
I don't know.
In the early 2000s, who are you going to get?
I don't know.
That's going to be that daring. Like Monica Bellucci or something?
That's really one of the only other people that maybe you could think of back then who was, you know, 13 years ago, almost 15 years ago now, and the movie was shot. You know, who is going to bring that level of sexuality, that overt hotness, and not care about it? You know, everybody's so prude these days, by and large. Like, unless you're, like, making a movie in Europe or whatever, like, no one wants to show anything. Nobody wants to do anything. Everybody just wants to, you know, just take it, you know, easy and simple. And sex is treated with such a – it's so looked down upon, you know, in my opinion, in cinema. Like, you know, you can show how many different ways of a person getting blown up or destroyed. And everybody can sit there and watch that in a movie theater. And then when there's sex, everybody gets all, like, uncomfortable. And, you know, critics are like, oh, it's sleazy, it's purient, you know, it all, you know, it's no good. You know, I'm sorry. You know, like, there's a reason why the sexy thriller has been around for so long, is when people do them real well, people want to watch them. So I can't understand how people who, say they enjoy cinema wouldn't love this movie. Doesn't have to be your favorite movie. But you need to watch this film and basically say, yeah, that's fucking cinema. Like, that's right there. Like, that is somebody flipping out and loving their job and loving the movie that they're making.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. If you love cinema, you need to watch Femme Fatale. I mean, bottom line, if you're a cinephile, Femme Fatale needs to be seen by you.
I totally
agree. I mean, right?
I agree. I've been saying it for years, and it stuns me when I say to people repeatedly.
Especially if you like Brian De Palma.
Exactly. And there's people out there, I know they haven't seen this movie. I know that
this is the last De Palma movie that's come out. I mean, I haven't seen Passion yet. That looked pretty fucking De Palma-y.
Passion is very De Palma-y. It's in the vein of body double, femme fatale, dressed to kill. It's in that realm of the psychosexual.
God, I need to see it like
Of the psychosexual thriller. You get some really kinky stuff with Rachel McAdams and Noomi Rapace. There's some masks and some sex toys, I think, and some weird shit.
Oh God!
You know, it's definitely fun. I have to watch it again. I saw it once. I felt like it was an entertaining rehash rather than a progressive explosion of his form and of his style. I felt like it was maybe like, not that he was on autopilot, but I felt like maybe he was like a little too comfortable within the trappings. But again, kind of have to see it again. I've watched Femme Fatale probably 50 times. So it's one of those.
Jesus.
I mean, no joke, between bits and pieces or full through. I mean, it's a crime. And how the movie's not on Blu-ray yet, I don't know. And it was just added to the Warner Brothers archives, site, and they've got it on DVD. They don't have a Blu-ray out. And I just can't figure out.
Why hasn't, Twilight put that out? Or Criterion loves De Palma? Because, I mean, Criterion put out Blow Up and Sisters, and they're going to be putting out Dressed to Kill, which I can't even wait to get.
Yeah, I hope that somebody grabs it and gives it a full-fledged special edition the way that it deserves, because it's one of the best cinephile movies that not enough cinephiles have actually seen. I think that there's some sort of stigma about it because it starred Rebecca Romijn and she was a supermodel, and because it was like this, it was like a low profile. I mean, dude, I saw this movie in L.A. I swear to God, there were 10 people in the theater. And I went opening night.
Well, I think the critics shunned it, and I think the fact that Rebecca Romijn's in it, and it's like, oh, Rebecca Romijn's starring in a movie. I mean, whatever. Antonio Banderas rocks in it.
I agree. Well, why don't you want to get into your top five, Antonio?
I'll do my top five Antonio Banderas. Okay. I remember when you first wanted to do top five Antonio Banderas, it was kind of like, I don't know if I can make a top five list, but as I perused the IMDb and remembered a lot of stuff he'd been in, of course you can make an Antonio Banderas top five list and have it be damn good. So my fifth one was his role in Expendables 3. I thought he was the perfect addition to an already outrageous and macho and... just, I love the Expendables films. I think they're great. And Antonio Banderas added all the comic relief and more you could ever need in Expendables 3. I thought he was absolutely hilarious. He's the guy that submits false information so he can meet Stallone and talk him into joining the Expendables group. He's awesome. He's got good back and forth with what's her face. She's like the MMA fighter, and she's in it. She's a terrible actress, but she has good back and forth with Antonio
Gina Carano from Haywire?
No, not her.
Oh.
She's good. I can't remember.
I didn't see Expendables 3 yet.
You got to see it, man. It's awesome. I mean, it's everything. It's the same cast, plus Harrison Ford, Antonio Banderas, Kelsey Grammer, and Mel Gibson is the bad guy.
I've been waiting to see it because I wanted to see it because I knew that they were going to come out with the unrated version. So
yeah, I haven't seen the unrated version, but I mean, I know it's PG-13. The only thing that's different about this movie compared to the other two is there's not as much CGI blood. I mean, that's kind of where it is. But Stallone promised that Expendables 4 was going to be rated R, so we got that going for us.
They're going to make another one after the third one didn't do huge?
Yeah, dude, and there's going to be an Expendables 4 and probably 5. And there's going to be an Expendables TV show that are going to star TV action stars, which is cool.
Oh, my God.
And there's supposed to be an Expendables.
Yes, I've heard about Expendables. Has that actually shot, or is that just something that
people talk about?
No,
that's just something that's been in like pre-production. But no, Expendables 4 is going to come out. Pierce Brosnan said he was going to be in it. And Hulk Hogan is supposed to be the villain, which I mean, come on, Hulk Hogan. I mean, I think that's a different change of pace, because I think in the original trilogy, you went from Eric Roberts to Jean-Claude Van Damme to Mel Gibson. I think that's a fantastic progression. And then you're going to go to Hulk Hogan, which is weird, but awesome at the same time, because, I mean, Hulk Hogan's awesome in Rocky III, and that's where, of course, he's going to be in it. Yeah, dude, I'm pumped. I hope these Expendables movies just get made. And I hope there's at least six of them. I hope there's at least six Expendables movies. I love them. I'll defend them to death. It's you know, everybody's like, oh, the dialogue's so bad and the acting's so cheesy. That's what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be this glamorized B movie.
Hey, listen, I had a great time with the first two, and I like the first one. I really like
it. I think the second one's better.
Yeah, I think the second one would be better too. And I'm looking, and I do want to see the third. I just kind of waited because I'd heard about the unrated, but I'll, if you say that the PG-13 is worth seeing, I'll check it out.
Well, I mean, the Blu-ray comes, it's PG-13 plus unrated.
Oh, all right.
The unrated, both of them are on there. I haven't seen the unrated version, but I mean,
but you were satisfied.
I only think it's a couple of minutes longer. Dude, I mean, the third act of the film, Stallone wanted to make a version of The Raid. And that's what the third act of the film is. Like, the climax is like them all fighting in this building that's blowing up and falling down with all these guys coming in. And, dude, and it's got Schwarzenegger, Harrison Ford, and Jet Li flying around in a helicopter together. And, of course, Harrison Ford's the pilot, saying all these witty one-liners that are all references to Harrison Ford's career. And then you get like the dude, and then you get the overly macho hand-to-hand fist fight between Mel Gibson that's super bulked up and Stallone. It's glorious.
All right, I'll check it out.
I'm going to get into my number 4 then. My number 4 is Haywire. I loved Haywire. I loved the macho cast of Haywire, and I loved Michael Douglas, but I particularly loved Banderas in that film, and I love how the character has a beard, the huge beard, the Mandy Patinkin Homeland beard, but bigger. And then by the end of the film, he doesn't have the beard. It's like perfect. I don't know if that's intentional or if it's like Antonio Banderas. I don't even know if he grew the beard. That could have just been like a wig. But anyway, I love Banderas in the film. He's so sleazy. He's always good as the sleaze with charm, because he's Latin, so he can totally pull it off so well. My number 3 is going to be Mambo Kings. I love that movie. That was one of those movies my mom showed me when I was younger, because she just loved she loved that film so much. It's like the Latin Fabulous Baker Boys. That's a good movie. I haven't seen that for a while. I need to track that one down. Number 2 is Femme Fatale. I mean, Antonio Banderas is so good in Femme Fatale. He's so good, and he's so funny, and then he's the total victim, and then he gets the ultimate satisfaction in the film, too. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Was that, like, the bridge scene? It's awesome. It's glorious. And then my number 1's a tie between Desperado and Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Those two are clearly Banderas' seminal performances. He's fantastic in both of them. I had to put both of them as a tie because they go hand in hand with one another. I love Desperado, but I really love Once Upon a Time in Mexico. I think that movie just kind of goes over the top and set the table for Robert Rodriguez wanting to make B movies. you know, the glamorized Mexican B movie, and I think it's perfect. I think Banderas is on fire in both of those movies, and they both encompassed his acting chops as well as his physical ability as an actor. And I think Banderas is a very good physical actor. I should have brought it up in Femme Fatale, but we went all over the place. But the best part about the striptease scene for me was the reaction shots of Banderas. I think he is so good when he is just standing there or reacting and he's not getting lines of dialogue. I love Banderas, man. He's so good. He's so funny. He can be so dramatic, and then he can be so macho all at the same time. So I think he has a very wide range and doesn't get the credit that he deserves. So that's my top five. What are yours?
Nice. Yeah, I've long been a fan. He's very expressive actor with the eyes and with the face and can convey stuff without dialogue, as you said. And, you know, he's been a guy who's said yes a lot throughout his career to a lot of crap the way that a lot of people have. So you take a look at his filmography and there's like all sorts of gems to be picked out of, you know, some of the other rubble, if you will, because there are definitely some movies in there that are not the greatest, but certainly a lot to talk about. My number five would be The Mambo Kings, another film just like you. My mother showed it to me, or I watched it in the same room with my mother because my mother was a huge fan of Antonio Banderas back in the early 90s, and that was a really lovely movie. I watched it a bunch of times. I loved the chemistry he had with Armand Asante. Just thought it was a really fun movie, very passionate. I remember the cinematography being really good. I think that was Michael Ballhaus, if I recall right. It was like one of, not sure if it was one of his, trying to remember what year it was, that movie came out exactly, but I have so many memories of watching it and enjoying it and seeing it, you know, where I grew up.
92.
Yeah, 92, exactly. So, number four for me is Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. I had a chance to take a class in college all about Pedro Almodovar, so I've seen pretty much all of his movies except for the last couple that have come out recently. And that, for me, is one of the best black comedies that I've ever seen. He's absolutely terrific in the movie. He had a great run of movies with Almodovar and stuff like Matador and Law of Desire and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. And he was just fantastic in that film. The great Carmen Mora is the lead, and if you've never seen it, I don't know how familiar you are with Almodovar's work. Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown is awesome flick. Definitely really recommend it. My number three is his absolutely perfect casting in The Mask of Zorro by Martin Campbell. Just one of the best, modern swashbucklers. The less said about the sequel, the better, in my opinion. But the first one with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Anthony Hopkins was, in my opinion, just a classic, rousing, exciting adventure. It had romance. It had a lot of great humor in it, and he was perfectly cast. I love that movie. Number two is his performance in Femme Fatale. The sleazy paparazzi photographer, you know, caught up in the web of deceit. Absolutely, you know, perfect. As you said, what he does with his, you know, eyes and his face during the striptease scene, is classic stuff. And, you can't help but feel bad for him. But at the same time, you also know that he shouldn't be doing what he's doing. So it's a classic damned if you do, damned if you don't performance. My number one, pretty much going away, is his performance in Desperado. I was completely and utterly obsessed with Desperado when I was 15 years old. It was like the greatest movie I'd ever seen up to that point. It was, for me, the gold standard of action films, and I still love it to this day. When you look back on it now, you see how little Robert Rodriguez had at his disposal to make that movie in comparison to, you know, more recent work. And even at the time, things that were being produced, that was 95, if I recall right. Just absolutely loved Desperado, a blast, super stylish. He had amazing chemistry with Salma Hayek. And the shots of him walking away from the explosions in that movie are absolutely epic. So that's my top five for Antonio.
Do you like Once Upon a Time in Mexico?
I do. I had a lot of fun. I've seen it maybe twice, but I remember having a lot of fun with it. I remember it being sort of jokier than I expected. I remember it being a little bit more comical and a little bit more over the top.
It's a lot of over the top.
Yeah. I remember it being very over the top, but I do remember having fun with it. And it's something I should probably check out again at some point. So I did remember having fun with it.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I was just,
overall I am
a
fan.
Just asking. Okay, cool. I'm going to move into my top five femme fatale. This was like hard, man. This is a list that no matter who listens to this, they're just going to think that the list is shitty, because there's like 100 femme fatales that you could all kind of put, maybe not 100, but there's a lot that can
this is your favorites. You know, we're not trying to say who's better than who here, probably. This is
right.
Just, you know, who's your favorite?
I'm just going to jump in then. My number five is Mrs. Robinson, Anne Bancroft from The Graduate. She's probably not the film noir staple. She's not the film noir staple of a femme fatale, but she's the ultimate femme fatale, man.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God. She totally fucks his life up hard. And with almost and just malicious intent. She's terrible. She's so good in it. I mean, she's amazing in the movie, but she's terrible. That's my number five. My number four is going to be Alex Frost, Glenn Close from Fatal Attraction. I mean, geez, man. That is like, that character's been on two top five lists of mine so far. When we first did Glenn Close for the first show, Alex Frost is a cinematic character that will resonate with anybody who watches it. She's so good, and she's so terrible. My number four is going to be Danielle and Dominique, Margot Kidder, from De Palma's Sisters. I can't remember when I first saw that movie, but I don't think I was as well-versed in De Palma as I am now. I saw it, and the movie just totally blew me away, and I was totally taken by surprise by the big reveal of the film. I loved it. I think that, I know you're probably going to disagree with me, but I think that is like the be-all, end-all femme fatale in any De Palma movie. So before you can say anything, I'm going to move on to my number two. My number two is Evelyn Mulray, Faye Dunaway from Chinatown. Aside from Chinatown being one of the most absolute perfect films ever, I think Faye Dunaway is so good in that movie. She's so good. She's as good, if not maybe a smidgen better, than Nicholson in that film. And she just totally fucks him. Literally and figuratively in that movie. I mean bad. And my number one's going to be a tie between Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity, because she's like the be-all, end-all femme fatale, I feel like. I mean, geez, De Palma opens femme fatale with the ultimate femme fatale. I mean, I love how he opened the movie with Rebecca Romijn laying in bed naked, smoking a cigarette, watching Double Indemnity. It was right away when I saw that, I knew I was going to love the movie. I just knew it. It was like, thank you, De Palma. Thank you for doing this.
And it's the scene where she's fucking over Neff.
Right. Of course. Because of course it is. And then, of course, on my list, Barbara Stanwyck is tied with Maddie Walker, Kathleen Turner from Body Heat, which, I mean, I think Body Heat's essentially a remake of Double Indemnity. I think it's the perfect companion film to Double Indemnity. But, I mean, Kathleen Turner in Body Heat is vicious. And, I mean, I've watched that movie probably 20 times. I can never get enough of it. And the ending of that film where the reveal happens and William Hurt puts everything together – and the reaction on his face and then the actual ending shot of the film, I think, is pitch perfect. Because William Hurt gets fucked over so hard in that movie. He's awesome, man. He's like the alpha macho, chasing tail, smooth talking, sleazy and seedy lawyer with his mustache, and he's always all sweaty with his hair slicked back from sweat, and changes his life and his person on a dime for Kathleen Turner, who just completely destroys his life. What happens to him in that movie is like worse than death, I think, in a way. He just completely gets obliterated by her. And it's great. It's so awesome. It's so awesome. I love watching the movie. And I know it's going to happen because I've seen the movie so much. It's one of my favorite movies. But that big reveal is one of the greatest things I think I've ever seen in cinema. It's fantastical. So that's my top five. And I can't even wait to hear what your list is. I'm sure it's going to be completely different than mine, with maybe an exception of one or two of them.
Well, my number five is a tie, and it's the only tie that will be on my list, is at number five. I'm going to have a tie with Jessica Rabbit from...
I thought about putting her on my list. Yes. Sorry.
It's so amazing, and that movie was... just a childhood favorite of mine, and it's a film that I feel has aged ridiculously well over the years. It's a movie that truly was made for kids and adults, and I've long been a fan of Robert Zemeckis. I feel that he is movie magic personified, and I just for me, Bob Hoskins' performance in that movie is just absolutely amazing, and Kathleen Turner, getting her to do the voice for Jessica Rabbit was just perfect. I mean, who else would you be able to do, you know, get to play, you know, do the voice for that role when it was written, and how it was written, and how it was animated and designed?
The sexiest cartoon character ever.
Yeah, it's absurd. So it's got to be in my top five. So it's a tie with five. My number five is a tie with Kathleen Turner's voice performance as Jessica Rabbit, and with Lena Olin in Peter Medak's Romeo is Bleeding. Have you seen this film?
Yes, that's a goodie.
That's a super goodie. It is a nasty film. I'm very excited. I haven't seen it in a while. It was a film that I used to watch a lot when it was on the rotation in HBO. And I'm looking forward. I grabbed it on DVD on a recent order of some stuff, and it's going to be coming soon. I'm looking forward to watching it in its entirety. As I recall, she is absolutely insane in that film, playing like a Russian dominatrix, and Gary Oldman's like corrupt cop gets mixed up with her, and there's a sequence, as I recall, where she like takes off her arm or something. It's such a nasty movie, and she's so vile in it. And when I saw it back in the day, it just completely blew me away. It's always stuck out in my head as this really, really, really gross, nasty little film that I think maybe has a cult following. I hope, because it bombed in the theaters, that's for sure. And people did not really give it great reviews, but it's a good sleazy movie that people should check out. Number four, Kathleen Turner in Body Heat, from Lawrence Kasdan, goes without saying, an absolutely brilliant performance in, you know, one of the genre's staple entries. Just an amazing film and amazing performance. You pretty much covered it. My number three is Rebecca Romijn in Brian De Palma's Femme Fatale. I think it's an awesome performance. It's hugely entertaining. It's incredibly sexual. It's very hot to watch. She went all out. She didn't care. As I said before, she's busting out with an accent. She's playing multiple characters, and she's in almost every scene of the film. I mean, really, like when it comes down to it, I mean, it's a huge commitment from an actress who, in my opinion, hadn't had the greatest of training up to that point to work with someone like De Palma. So even more kudos. Number two, Linda Fiorentino in John Dahl's The Last Seduction. It's one of the ultimate ball-breaking performances that I've ever seen. And this was a very tough category for me to pick five from. I couldn't pick five. I had to go with six because I love noir and I love the femme fatale, the femme fatale character in any movie where you get to play around with it. So it was just impossible to pick these. But Linda Fiorentino and John Dahl's Last Seduction, ridiculous. Have you seen The Last Seduction?
No, but I just looked it up on IMDb, and the poster already has me sold.
It's just incredible. I actually just grabbed it on...
and Bill Pullman's in it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And not only... Peter Berg. Peter Berg right. is in the film, and he is so good. And she fucks him over so hard for her. It's awesome. The Last Seduction is just one. It was that movie that came out. It aired on TV before it came out in the theater, thus not allowing Linda Fiorentino the chance to be nominated for an Oscar because the movie has to premiere in the theaters before it hits TV. Back in the day, this movie for some reason was aired on TV before it came out, and had it not, she would have been nominated for an Oscar. Like, it's just a ridiculous performance. It's the ultimate ice queen. And my number one, without question, Barbara Stanwyck and Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. It's just the gold standard of femme fatale. Everyone should be compared to her in that film. Between the dialogue, the rapid fire dialogue, and her amazingly emotionless performance at times, it's incredible. I absolutely love it. And I think that, again, pretty much everybody taking on, the role of a femme fatale sort of needs to watch that movie for inspiration and see how it was done back in the day when you couldn't get naked and couldn't swear and couldn't show a lot of blood and couldn't get all down and dirty the way that people do nowadays. And I will also say one runner up, because this was impossible, but a major runner up, I will say, Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct.
Yeah.
Just one of the ultimate, sexually charged performances that you're ever going to see from an actress in the prime of her beauty. I mean, there's just no denying it. Sharon Stone was lit like a goddess by Jan de Bont in that film. And Paul Verhoeven knew, because he's a sick fuck, he knew exactly how to exploit Sharon Stone in all the best ways, whether or not it was to her liking. As the old story goes about that great interrogation scene. But in any
right.
event, Sharon Stone, huge runner-up. For the femme fatale is always going to be an area for me that I love obsessing over because I just love film noir. So that'd be my top five.
I can't believe that there's one in particular that I just thought of that didn't cross my mind that had it earlier, I would have. But I just want to give a shout-out to Ellen Barkin in The Sea of Love.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
She's an honorable mention. And then I can't believe neither one of us had Jane March from Color of Night on our list. Because,
yeah,
I mean, I know that movie's outrageous, and
yeah,
we need to cover that. But, I mean, she's like the epitome. She is the epitome of a femme fatale. I mean, God, that movie's just, it's absurd. That movie's absurd. But yeah, I just thought of that when you were reading yours off, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if he's going to have Jane March from Color.
Dude, there's so many. I had more cross-offs and more rearranges with this list than I've had on any top five yet. So it was nearly impossible. So
Right on, man.
So to close out the show, there were two big trailers that came out this week. And Frank, why don't you talk about the one that
got me all chubbed?
Exactly.
I'd love to. It is the new Oren Moverman film, Time Out of Mind, where Richard Gere plays an alcoholic drifter. I hope that this is the movie that Richard Gere at least gets nominated for, because you want to talk about some guy that's gotten shit upon hardcore forever. It's Richard Gere. The guy's never been nominated for an Oscar, and I think that's completely unacceptable. Chicago, Brooklyn's Finest, Arbitrage. I mean, Days of Heaven. The list is endless, but particularly Chicago and Arbitrage, and even Brooklyn's Finest. This guy, he looks like he is just bearing everything for this film, and I'm so excited for it. And of course it looks, heavy and dark, and I mean the title of the film, Time Out of Mind, and everything. I can't even wait for this movie to come out. I'm so excited for it. We'll post both of the trailers that we talk about, the one that Nick's about to talk about, and then this one. We'll post them on our Facebook page so the people can see them if they haven't already.
Do you get the impression of, from the trailer, what do you think, I mean, this is the homeless film where he's going
to... Trying to reconnect with his daughter?
Exactly. So
that's a bartender, and he's an alcoholic. It's awesome. But anyway, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, there was that film, the trailer slightly reminded me of that film. I'm trying to remember the name of it now, of course. It was with De Niro and Paul Dano.
Oh, God, naming something Flynn?
Yeah, Being Flynn.
I never saw that. That just looked way too heavy-handed.
It wasn't terrible. I remember liking both of them in it. I remember it being definitely sort of, you know, very on the nose, you know, with everything. But I remember it sort of being undeniably heart-tugging and powerful at times. And I remember De Niro being excellent in it. But, yeah, I mean, Oren Moverman's a really interesting filmmaker. He's made some very interesting stuff throughout his career. I think The Messenger is absolutely intense and pretty much blew me away. Rampart is wildly underrated. I'm very anxious to see what he'll do here with Richard Gere, who I've also long been a fan of, and it is criminal to think that he hasn't been given at least one Oscar nomination for one of his performances. You know, it's another insanity, but whatever.
I just can't believe that John C. Reilly got nominated in Chicago over Richard Gere. I mean, John C. Reilly's awesome, but still.
Yeah,
Richard Gere
was the heart and soul
of that fucking movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to understand, But yeah, so it definitely looks very interesting. And again, it's another effort from an interesting filmmaker who's a writer and a director. He also had a hand in writing, I think, Todd Haynes's I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan movie, which I thought was wild. So should be very interesting to see that, definitely. Other trailer is the new Denis Villeneuve film, the guy who directed Prisoners and Enemy. This is his new movie, Sicario, which stars Emily Blunt, Benicio del Toro, and Josh Brolin, and it looks to be a super intense look at cartel violence in Mexico and right over the border in El Paso, I think, and it looks very hardcore. Emily Blunt looks to be very much in the intensity zone, del Toro looking pretty mean, and it has the benefit of being shot by Roger Deakins, which, of course, is a huge boon to any movie. Roger Deakins shot Prisoners for Villeneuve a couple of years ago, did some amazing work there. And Villeneuve is coming off of the incredible brain teaser Enemy from last year, which I know you haven't seen yet, and we'll maybe watch that, maybe for a podcast or maybe even when, the meeting of the mind visit happens. Maybe we'll save that one for then. But I think Villeneuve is a hugely exciting filmmaker to look out for. He's going to be the guy that's going to apparently take over the reins for Blade Runner on the sequel. And I think that he, so far through his films, has exhibited style and smarts. So here's hoping that Sicario continues in that tradition because it looks incredibly hardcore. So I'm very curious to see it. And other than that, anything that you picked up during the week that you want to let people know about? Any new Blu-rays? I know I got a few things.
I got the most recent things I got were the two Twilight Time labels, Night of the Generals and Zardoz, which I still haven't watched. I got Flesh and Bone.
Oh, yeah.
Flesh and Bone,
though, Dennis Quaid, Meg Ryan.
Yeah.
You're going to love that.
Flesh and Bone, that you were beating it off hard to. I can't believe I just said that. that you absolutely were smitten with and were telling me about. So I picked it up cheap on Amazon, and then I also got Cohen and Tate, which is a film Eric Red did that we both were really, really wanted to see after Gary told us how great it was. So I'm looking forward to watching, trying to get that done over the weekend.
Yeah, I've got my Blu-ray of Conan and Tate should be here Monday, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. Last week, I got the Onion two Harold Becker films, The Onion Field and Malice, both put out by Kino. The Onion Field is a movie I had not seen before, and I watched it last night, and I found it to be extremely powerful, upsetting, intense movie. John Savage, Ted Danson, James Woods from 1979, true story, true crime. Story, very intense movie. I highly recommend it. Malice was one of those solid, you know, 90s suspensers with Alec Baldwin.
Written by Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, Aaron Sorkin, and just a sleazy, you know, sort of devious thriller. It's got some good twists, and it's a good one. And I grabbed that this week. I look forward to revisiting that. And I also grabbed the much hated, but much loved by me, and I'm looking forward to you seeing it because I know you didn't get a chance to see it, was Chappie, which is the weird sort of unexplainable robot movie that came out earlier this year that from Neil Blomkamp, the director of Elysium and District 9, and nobody went to see it. It was shit upon by critics, and I don't really understand why. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but I think that
I really want to see it.
I think that it has an incredible personality. It has some great ideas that are explored. The visual effects are absolutely fucking amazing. And I had never been exposed to the South African rapping duo known as Die Antwoord before I saw this film. And the inclusion of these two vulgar, strange, just completely unique and bizarre people really kicks that movie up a notch for me. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was nuts, and the last half hour is totally wild, and the ending sort of goes to some of the same berserk lengths that Lucy, Luc Besson's Lucy, went to. It kind of just goes wild at the end and doesn't care. And I think it's a lot better than people gave it credit for being. I thought that Charlotte Copley's performance as the robot was fantastic, in motion capture performance, and the visual effects and how clean they were and how that was clearly not a real robot on set. I don't get it. I don't get how they do things these days when they're looking this clean.
I mean,
so I don't think it's perfect. I've watched it. I watched it this week again. I gave it a second full viewing. But I still say I would rather take a flawed R-rated, you know, auteur-driven film from somebody like Neil Blomkamp than the next Marvel homogenized bullcrapola that they're going to, you know, pour out on 4,000 screens and make a gajillion dollars off of. So that's just me personally. I say for people, take a chance on Chappie. I think it's pretty cool. So I think that's it for this week, right? Unless you got anything else to add. Next week we are going to be off for our regular show, but we will have a very special guest that maybe we won't say right now who it is, just to leave some people in suspense, but we will have a very special interview podcast that will drop next weekend in place of our normal movie chat. So I know you're
excited. I'm gonna be out of town next weekend at a bachelor party, but we will drop an amazing podcast the weekend, or I should say Thursday night is when we'll drop it for the weekend, and it will be very, very good. So
it will be, and we also have a fun one to drop, you know, early this week as well for people.
Yeah, Monday we'll have another one. It's crazy around here. I had to buy a daily planner to keep track of everything for the first time in my life. I have a daily planner that's color coordinated. So
yeah,
shit's getting real here at Podcasting Softly headquarters. So but yeah, okay, I don't need to announce what we're doing for our next show because we're going to be off, and then, okay, yeah, we're good then.
Very good. Well, yeah, another great chat as always, and we'll be keeping people people posted throughout the week with all sorts of fun stuff.
Absolutely. This was a great show. I loved watching Femme Fatale, and I loved talking about it and talking about De Palma. So this won't be the last of Brian De Palma on Podcasting Them Softly. That's all I got to say.
I agree as well.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening.